Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Right Club. The first rule of Right Club is you don't talk about Right Club, but we'll make an exception in your case.
Hello and welcome to Right Club, the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. I'm Teresa and I'm here with Nicola, Stephanie and Heather.
Hello.
Hello.
Unfortunately, Pat and Linda aren't with us today. This week on Right Club, life's a beach and we're on it. We're talking summer reads with holidaymakers in Greece. Stephanie will be sharing her work in progress, Nicola will be sharing a techie tip, and we're absolutely delighted to be interviewing Asia Mackay, whose first novel, Killing It, is out any day now, and we think it's going to be the biggest bestseller this summer. Heather and Jill Simpson will be telling us what's on their bedside table, but first, Heather is going to ask us to
name the novel.
Okay. This book was first published in 1980 and has remained so successful since its publication that it was adapted for the stage in 1999. It was said to be triggered by a simple desire to write something about beards.
Beards?
Beards? What, as in facial hair?
Okay. This author was born in Wales on the 13th of September 1916. And has been referred to as one of the greatest storytellers of the 20th century.
Oh, well, I don't know who
the
that
Times
is.
placed them 16th on its list of 50 greatest British writers since 1945. He was mischievous, a grown-up being mischievous. He addresses you, a child, as someone who knows about the world. He was a grown-up, and he was bigger than most. Who is on your side? That must have something to do with it. That was a quote from Quentin Blake on the lasting appeal of this author.
I know it. Yeah,
I've got an idea.
I know who it is. I know who the author is.
I know it, and I've got an anecdote.
Oh, brilliant. Okay. So the first line, or the first few lines, what a lot of hairy men there are around nowadays. When a man grows hair all over his face, it's impossible to tell what he really looks like. Perhaps that's why he does it. He'd rather you didn't know.
Oh, no, I'm not so sure. It's definitely Roald Dahl.
I got Roald Dahl.
When you said bigger than most, I thought
the BFG. Yeah, that's what I thought.
But I don't recognise the beard thing at all. You're going to have to... It's a West End show, which
the BFG is.
BFG is, Matilda is, but that's not about beards. Okay, I give in.
It's the Twits.
The Twits.
I don't know that one.
I just thought it was quite lighthearted. And
yeah. So. When you said about mischievous and addressing children like adults, I thought that's Roald Dahl.
Born in Wales and one of the greatest writers. When I thought it was the BFG, I had an anecdote. But when I was a student studying theatre, we were lucky enough to have the opportunity to take some shows to the Edinburgh Festival. And the group that I was involved in, we decided to do the BFG. We wanted to do a children's show. And it hadn't been on in the West End or the Film Made or anything then. And when we wrote to Roald Dahl's agent asking for permission to make a musical adaptation, they wrote back and said the film and theatre rights had been sold. So one of my fellow students, Ian Kidd, wrote directly to Roald Dahl about this and said, look, it's just a student show we're taking to Edinburgh. And he said, yeah, go ahead, which I thought was rather lovely.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so we took that show to Edinburgh and he was in Edinburgh doing book signings while we were there as well. So that was quite fun.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway. I love reading them to the grandchildren.
Oh, they're brilliant to read aloud, aren't they? They're wonderful.
S.T.O.
Trot.
That's
the big friend. S.T.O.
Trot.
Sad, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, it made me feel sad when I went to my kids.
Yes, I love it.
Anyway, that was a good one. Had us all guessing and getting it wrong.
I've actually got the last two. Something's happened to my brain.
Oh, there you go. You're getting into it. Okay. Thank you. Thanks, Heather. So now Stephanie is going to read the next instalment of Lacking Grace before we give her some feedback.
Okay, this is a scene taken from somewhere in the middle of the book, something around chapter 30, I believe. And it's a scene in the laundry where Grace is working with lots of the other women. Lillian Arnold was particularly vociferous in her objection to the gender of the new psychiatrist. "As far as I'm concerned, doctoring's for men," she declared. Her meaty forearms juddered as she rubbed soap onto shirt collars. "Women have got no business meddling in men's work." "Well, I'm not sure Elizabeth Garrett Anderson would agree with you," laughed Eddie. "Never heard of her." Lillian sniffed and let her chin disappear into the fat of her neck. "Famous doctor and suffragette," Eddie replied. "Well, that's as maybe, but she could..." Sorry. "Well, that's as maybe, but she could be keeping a man what's got a family to feed out of a job. Have you thought of that?" Lillian threw the shirt into the soaking tub and reached for another, wiping her forehead with the back of her wrist before she attacked it. "Women shouldn't be meddling in medicine, especially not in a place like this." "Oh, please, that's ridiculous. More than half the patients in this place are women," Eddie scoffed. "Exactly." Lillian was triumphant. "Women don't have the nerves for it, see?" Eddie gave a little laugh, warming to the debate. "All right, so what about Anna Freud?" "Anna who?" "Sigmund Freud's daughter." "Who the hell is Siegfried? What's his name when he's at home?" Lillian snorted and looked to the rest of the women for support. "Sigmund," Eddie corrected. "Sigmund Freud." "Sounds like a bleeding foreigner for a start." Lillian tossed her hair back. "You must have heard of him. He's the greatest psychologist the world has ever known." Lillian threw a contemptuous glance in Eddie's direction. "I've got no time for bloody Germans. And that's something else. With a name like Hoffman, I wouldn't be surprised if this one's a Nazi too." "Do you really think so, Lillian?" asked one of the other ladies, clutching her throat with both hands, eyes widening. "Of course she isn't a Nazi." Eddie shook her head, still chuckling to herself. "You are such a scandalmonger sometimes." "So how would you know whether she's a Nazi or not then, clever clogs?" Lillian deliberately let the soap drop onto the workbench, then put her hands on her hips, turned towards Eddie and stood with her feet apart. "You got a special radar to find spies, have you? How do you know she's not a German spy?" "Lillian, the war has been over for quite a while now, so there's not a whole lot of spying left to do, and I'm quite sure the hospital board took references." Eddie winked at Grace and raised her eyebrows. Lillian took a step forward. "Oh, yes, and you'd know all about references, would you? You're on the hospital board, are you?" "Of course not, but anyone with half an ounce of sense would realise." "You think you're something clever, don't you?" Lillian sneered and let her head wobble from side to side as she spoke. "You with your la-di-da voice and your nose in the air like you're better than everyone else." Eddie stopped what she was doing and faced Lillian. The smile had gone from her face. She took a deep breath and then spoke in clipped tones. "No, Lillian. Like you and everybody else, I speak the way I speak because of my upbringing and education." "What's wrong with the way I speak?" Lillian bristled. "Nothing's wrong with the way you speak, Lillian. It's simply that what you say on this occasion happens to be utter rot."
Okay. Yeah. Nice dialogue.
I just love that last line. I thought it was tremendous. Utter rot.
Yeah.
Body language in that scene was just fantastic, wasn't it? Yeah. Lillian's body language. You could just, from her meaty forearms to her fat of her neck, you could picture her so clearly, couldn't you?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I commented on the, you know, her chin disappearing into the fat of her neck as a nice bit of descriptive detail there. And we were talking last week about dialogue and how it reveals character and class and so on. And obviously Eddie is an educated person from a very different background to Lillian, who she's speaking to, who's a bit more down-to-earth working class. And that comes across without you having to tell us. So I think that's very well done. And as we've said on previous occasion, very good at the body language as well.
Thank you.
Yeah. There was a word that jumped out at me as not quite... where it came just after her meaty forearms, where they juddered as she was rubbing the. I just wondered about that word. It just didn't feel quite right. But
okay,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
I noticed as well. There's a slight slip of point of view.
Oh, dun.
Yes. when Lillian drops the soap deliberately, Lillian deliberately let the soap drop.
Good
drop
moment of menace that was.
Yes, but how does Grace, who's telling the story, how does Grace know it was deliberate? So that's a slight slip of point of view there.
And also, you know, I felt Grace is a little bit absent from this section. Yeah, you know, that was just a feeling like, where is Grace? I know that she's mentioned once.
Yeah.
Or she has one comment, I think. But, you know, that was a, I don't know,
Well, a fight was going to erupt. So right. Lillian and Eddie are going to end up having a fight.
Right.
And that's going to lead.
Lillian, you can tell she's a bruiser right from the first moment. Really.
Yeah.
It made me think about my mother-in-law, because my mother-in-law, when she first came across a female bank manager, was horrified that this woman had taken a man's job.
It was very much a conversation of the time.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, and you know, going back, if a woman married, she was expected to leave her job. And you know, I mean, lots of women left teaching because they weren't allowed to be married as teachers, and many, I suspect, sacrificed a married good life careers, to have a teaching career as well.
I like the way you wove the humour through it. So although the tension was building, there was humour. I mean, not much more spying to be done as the war was over. Yeah. And again, you're setting the time and telling us where we are in the story. So really good.
I wondered about the opening sentence here. Obviously it's the narrative voice, but you say Lillian Arnold was particularly vociferous in her objection to the gender of the new psychiatrist. It's just the vocabulary doesn't sound right to me. It's and then I thought, actually, do we even need it? Because we see her being vociferous, don't we?
Yes, we do.
And objecting.
Quite right.
So I wondered about that. Yeah. And the other thing that struck me, I've said, you know, sometimes you could drop the odd speech tag. I like where you give physical action or description. The dialogue is great, but, this is the but, is it a little bit overwritten? So here are some words you use instead of said. Declared, laughed, sniffed, replied, and so on.
Snorted.
Sneered, bristled. And I just think it's a little bit overdone that.
I agree.
That's just my opinion. But the dialogue itself is great as far as I'm concerned. And there was, I enjoyed it.
You don't really need to even say, as far as I'm concerned, doctor rooms for men. Lillian's meaty forearms juddered as she rubbed soap on his shirt collars is enough to attribute the speech to Lillian.
I think it is, and when you say, please, that's ridiculous, more than half the patients in this place are women, Eddie scoffed. You could lose Eddie Scott.
Exactly.
Sure. Not all of them.
I completely agree.
Just a little bit. Yeah. Anyway, I'll give you those.
Thank you very much. Okay. See, it's never finished.
No. Well, how do you know when it is? You know, I suppose.
Well, you don't.
You've just got to take a view, don't you, at some
point. I spotted. In the opening chapter, I've got the word neighbour twice in quick adjacent paragraphs.
Yeah. But, you know.
How many times have I written that first chapter?
Yeah, but the thing is, you know, sometimes it's okay. You know, that's fine. You need to use the same word because that's what it is.
Yeah.
You know.
That you can overthink things.
Yeah. Now, over to Nicola for a techie tip.
Yes. Well, I was recommended a bit of software by Stephanie called the Novel Factory. And I started to use it because you get 30 days free trial. And it's actually software that you can use. You can download if you've got Windows, or you can use it online. And I started using it online because I'm a Mac user. And there are, it came across as really, really good and really intuitive to use. And I couldn't really, think why I wasn't using it more. And I was trying to analyse that, and I realised it because it's such a hard name to remember, the Novel Factory. I just kept totally forgetting the name of what it was called. So I had to keep going and looking for the name that Steph had given me in the first place. So I think they could come up with a different name, perhaps. But the other, it's actually really good because it's got a planning section, and as you click into it, it tells you what you're supposed to be doing in that section. So the instructions are very good. And then when you go, it tells you what to do after you've read the bit about what you're supposed to be doing. It tells you what to do next very clearly. So it goes through premise, skeleton of the story, character introductions, a short synopsis. And that was when I realised I'd spelt my synopsis wrong, because I thought, oh, what? And then you do an extended synopsis, and then you have goal to decision cycle in each scene. So it's teaching you how to write as well as you actually writing, and you don't have to do all this bit before you can actually start writing. It gets you to do. Go on.
What I was going to say is, at a later date, when you're looking for a synopsis to send off, it's there. You might want to edit it, modify it, but you've got it up front.
And I think the other good thing about this, if you like doing this stuff, is that when you're not feeling particularly creative about writing, I think you could go in and do some of the planning,
mm-hmm.
and that possibly would lead you then to want to write something.
Yeah.
So, and you can, you don't have to do all this. You can just jump straight to the writing bit. But and for example, it had head scenes and tail scenes, which is, we've talked before about active and passive scenes, where each head scene has got a goal, a conflict, a disaster, and each tail scene has got a reaction, dilemma, and decision. So if you don't know anything about story writing a book at all, I would say definitely take a look at it. It fell down... Oh, let me tell you how much it costs first before I tell you what, where it fell down. Was on the monthly basis, if you're buying annually, you pay $6.25 a month or $50 a month. So, and the only difference seems to be how much storage you get with it, you know, whether how many megabytes storage you get. And if you buy annually, you get 2 months free. So it's not expensive, certainly not in the early days.
I bought it as a once-off.
Yeah, because you've got Windows.
Yeah, so I've got Windows, and I bought it, I think it was about $40.
Yes,
it wasn't
it's not expensive,
expensive
at all, no. Where it fell down for me was I went to export from it. I feel quite uncomfortable having stuff on computers that could die, so I do like things that are in the cloud. And the online version of this is on the cloud, in the cloud, so I thought I'd give it a go. Where I didn't like it was when I went to export it, it didn't do what I expected. So it exported it in a way, it didn't put the chapter headings in, just because I hadn't known where I had to go. So I had to go back and, anyway. It just, I think, for me, it would stifle my creativity because I'm such a good student, I would feel I had to go and do all this stuff first.
Before
I wrote anything. And in fact, I haven't written anything in the month that I've been playing with this, so I don't know whether that's the fault of that or whether it's just I've been writing poetry or whatever. So I went then and thought, okay, so let's have a look at what's on for Macs. And I found a really good article on Medium, which was the top five writing softwares for Macs. And the author of the article, he likes Ulysses, but apparently is a really big beast, and it's for people who are writing blog posts and articles. Journalists would use that. The next one is Scrivener, but there
that's
is...
It's expensive.
Well, it's expensive, and as I know from my business partner using it, it's 112 videos to watch before you even know how to use it. Then the next one down, a simple version, a simple solution, might be Notebooks, which apparently you can set out, so there's three screens, and you can have, you know, your, for example, your Act 1, Act 2, Act 3, and then you can have your different chapters in different notes within your act, so it looked like it would be quite simple to use. IA Writer is another one they recommend. And then I looked at Write! Exclamation mark app. So Write! App. It's cloud-based. It creates personalised... this is what I really liked about it, because, you know, when we critique each other's work, some people do it online, some people do it in printing out, and some people print out and then write and then pass the comments over. And I use Google Docs, so you all go in and make comments on Google Docs, which is great, but then you can't print it out with comments. So this one creates personalised link shares and collaborations. So so I think that if I sent you a link to some work in progress in Write app, then you would then be able to make your comments on it, and I would then be able to edit right there, taking your comments into account. So you could all make your comments on the same document, because what I'm thinking now is, how am I ever going to find all these bits of paper or find all these comments for when I want to edit and take them into account? So I'm thinking this might be quite good. $24.95 minus 30% if you share on social media. So very affordable indeed.
Right. And that's called Write App.
Yes.
W-R-I-T-E
exclamation mark app.
App. Okay. Yeah. And so that's for Macs.
Yeah, that's for Macs.
And for...
Well, it isn't. It's cloud-based, so it's...
All right, so it could be for anybody.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
That's interesting.
So that's the one I...
Well, I know that I agree with you about the... I mean, I use the Novel Factory... Well, I haven't used the Novel Factory, but I will with my next book, because it's got all of the organisation tools that I need. And as you say, you don't have to...
Tools together.
You don't have to do your 25-word pitch and your 150-word pitch before you start writing.
No.
But it does have the tools to let you do it. And I find, because it's on my desktop... I don't forget it. I've got
icon
that says Novel Factory.
Right.
I just click on it.
Okay.
And
the other interesting thing about Novel Factory was it had spaces for draft one, draft two, and draft three.
Yeah.
And I wasn't sure if not seeing them side by side, I wouldn't be able to tell the difference between the drafts or whatever, but you think you will be able to.
Yes, I mean, I've quite successfully used Word to write Lacking Grace, and I'm very comfortable with it. But I just like the fact that the Novel Factory's got the files and the organisation, yes, and the structure to hold things away. Right. But I believe all the documents are still in Word. Mm-hmm. Even though that they're being...
Ah, so it's like an add-on to Word.
Oh, yeah. Well, hang on, this is where I might have gone wrong then, because I was copying and pasting from Google Docs into it, into First Draft, and I don't know.
It's probably not something to talk about on the podcast, but we can look at that. But
I would definitely say if you're a new writer, you know, these things can help you learn how to write.
Because they give you a bit of structure.
But I think you should just start writing first before you, you know, because the simpler it is, the more likely you are to actually write something.
Okay. Mm. Yeah. Thanks, Nicola. That was interesting. Very good. Well, summer reads and holiday books have been on our minds lately. Stephanie and I went out and about to talk to people on the beach about what makes a good summer read.
Wow, look at this place. Teresa and I are on a beach looking at a turquoise sea and golden sand. We're in the south of Greece in the Peloponnese in an area called the Mani. Aren't we lucky?
It's fabulous and hot.
Very hot. Anyway, we've come here today because we want to find out what people are reading this summer. And we thought, what better place than a beach full of people lying on sunbeds and towels? So that's what we're here for.
Well, I can see some people reading over there, so let's go and talk to them.
Let's do that. So, what's your name?
Jill.
Jill, and where are you from, Jill?
Bishopstoke.
And so you're here on holiday in Greece. You're lying on a sunbed, and you've got a book there that you're reading. What's that book?
It's You and Me Always.
By?
Jill Mansell.
And why did you choose that book to bring on holiday?
Because I like her books. Well, they're easy reading, a bit of romance and nothing too taxing.
So you can nod off on your sunbed in the sun.
Easily,
pick it up again.
Yeah,
I know just what you mean. That's excellent.
Yeah.
So that's what makes a good summer read for you, is it?
It is, something light, nothing too... nothing too sad. I'll keep that for home. When I can cry in peace.
Yeah, you don't want to be crying on a sunbed, do you? Excellent. Thank you for your time.
Barbara Easton. I'm from Bolton in England. I'm reading a trashy novel by a gentleman called Andrew Peterson, and it's called Option to Kill. Believe it or not, it's the third one in a series of books, and I can remember the main character from the first two, but that's about it. Something that doesn't involve a lot of thinking, you know, that you don't have to think too deeply about, that just... And I like action stuff, you know, a bit of violence. No, not lots of sex, but...
So not too heavy.
Bit of violence, but nothing... you know, but the old firefight and the odd murder is okay. Something that's just easy to take in as you go through the book without having to think about it. No big plots you're trying to work out. Just dead simple stuff, easy read.
So what makes a good summer read is, I think, something that you can pick up and put down, and it's not so complicated that you have to go back to pick up the thread every time you put it down. This holiday I've been reading Man and Wife by Tony Parsons, which is a book that he wrote, I guess, in the late 90s. I was slightly disappointed with it because when I read a book, I like it to hang together. And when it comes to an end, I like to feel that the ending is a satisfying ending. Whereas this one, it was a little bit disjointed, didn't always seem to follow. But nevertheless, it was a good summer read. I chose it because I've read three or four more recent novels by Tony Parsons on a holiday earlier this year. That was a trilogy about a London detective called D.C. Max Wolfe. Very contemporary, deals with a lot of modern criminological issues like terrorism and stabbings in London, things like that. And those novels were particularly good, which was why I chose this Man and Wife. And I suppose, is part of the reason why I was slightly disappointed with it. I think with Tony Parsons, he's obviously got much better as a writer as time has gone on, so that you see in his early novel, there are things that he needs to improve, whereas in these later ones, they hang together much better and are much more satisfying to read.
Katie Thomas, and she writes about the war, and we're in the Blitz at the minute, and the sewing bees, they work in a factory making uniforms for the Navy and the Army, the Air Force. They've decided to do a sewing circle and a knitting circle to send X, Y and Z to the ships and everywhere.
Secrets of the Sewing Bee by Kate Thompson.
Anything by Mae Vinci, anything by Margaret Dickinson, which is a local author in Lincolnshire, anything by Katie Flynn. I've got all the trilogy of Burracoon, but can't tell you the author. She wrote five and they are brilliant. You get immersed because you know it happened. And
so well researched, would you say?
Yes, oh,
your name, where do you come from?
I'm Kevin and I live in Stupa.
So you live here, not just on holiday?
No.
Well, it's nice to find you on the beach. What are you reading, Kevin?
The Ides of March, Valerio Massimo Manfredi. It's about Caesar. The last few weeks of Caesar's reign, before he was slaughtered by Brutus.
And so do you think that kind of thing with lots of violence makes a good summer read?
No, I'm just interested in reading all Roman books.
Do you think there's anything in particular that makes a book better for a summer read?
I'm not into romances. I don't think that makes any difference. It all depends. If you can sit down on a beach and actually read a book, and when you're on the beach, not get disturbed by bats and balls and things like that.
People with microphones.
Well, not necessarily people, my bat and balls and stuff like that. If you can just get into a book and you're not disturbed, I think it's enjoyable.
Yeah. Είμαι πολύ απασχολημένος και δεν έχω χρόνο για να διαβάσω.
Ευχαριστώ.
So what did that chap say at the end?
He was speaking Greek, and he said, "I'm too busy working. I don't have time to read."
Oh, bless him.
Yeah. Yes.
I was just a bit taken aback. It was obviously a menu he was looking at.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, I love the way that, you know, the way that you can hear waves in the background and then tweeting birds in the background.
Oh, it was beautiful.
And some people wanted a light read, and some people just wanted violence.
Yeah, so many people were reading thrillers, dark stuff. Yeah. It was really interesting because, you know, I suppose we went with the expectation that everybody would be reading chick lit or wanting something light, but that certainly wasn't the case.
I would have thought people wanted something light on the beach. Mm-hmm.
Well, a lot of them said that they wanted things that they could pick up and put down because they wanted to nod off or go and get a beer or fall asleep or, you know, what have you, go for a swim, I suppose. But almost everybody was reading. There's a lot of Kindles around.
And a lot of paperbacks.
And a lot of paperbacks. Yes. Yeah. No hardbacks that I remember.
No, but they're not. No. You know, how many people buy hardbacks even?
Well, you can't take one holiday, can you?
No. Fill up your luggage restrictions. But, you know, and they were using the book swaps in the resort as well, which is a great thing. Yeah,
the book swaps were great.
Yeah, they're fabulous.
I was beginning to wish I'd bought a bag of books to swap out. So there were some really good titles there.
Yeah. So, yeah, it was very, very interesting. Well, speaking of summer reads that are full of danger, darkness, thrillers and humour, it's over to our interview with Asia Mackay.
We're very excited to welcome Asia Mackay to Write Club, the podcast. Asia's debut novel, Killing It, is coming out on the 12th of July and is already being hailed as a hot summer read. So welcome, Asia.
Thank you for having me, Stephanie.
So your book, Killing It, is about Alexis Tyler. Tell us about her.
Well, Lex is a secret agent with an underground branch of the security services. She's also a first-time mum. So the story's about her first mission back after returning from maternity leave and having to juggle both these very different lives and how she gets on with that. with trying to solve all the problems she's being thrown at work and still having to rush home in time for bath time.
Well, we've all been there, haven't we? But maybe not.
Maybe with less violence, hopefully.
Yes, less violence. So where did you get the idea for that? It's a wonderful idea, wonderful juxtaposition. How did that come to you?
It came to me when I was crawling out our kids' room one night, trying not to wake the baby. And all I could think about was how maybe if I had some kind of a specialist spy training, I'd managed to actually get to the door without him waking and screaming the house down. And it sparked an idea, and it just kind of went from there, really. The idea of having nappy bags, like we packed them full of everything going. And the idea of having a gun packed in there too, it just seemed so surreal and so out of place, but also, you know, potentially amusing, like, you know, rushing around your everyday mum life, but you've got this secret identity of being a kind of assassin on the sly, that no one knows the secret life of yours.
Sounds like fun. You talked about crawling out of the bedroom, your children's bedroom. So you had how many children at that point?
That was when I had three children at that point. I now have four.
So where did you find the time to write a book with three children to look after?
I think it's funny, actually. My kids are all really close together as well. So I've done two under two and then three and under. And I think once you get through that and survive that chaos, you suddenly realise how much you can really fit in when you start your day at 5 a.m. So I guess it started very slowly. I had this idea. I mulled it over for a few months, and then I didn't actually really start even trying to write it till the baby was about 6 months. And I just jotted down notes, jotted down ideas, didn't really think much of it. And then I suddenly decided, I was like, right, okay, I've got this idea. I've always loved writing. Haven't really done anything since school, but I might as well give it a go, as this idea doesn't seem to be going away. And I need to see if I can actually do it. And the idea of writing a book, I couldn't decide if I was going to write it as a TV series or as a book. And I thought, well, as a book, you have more chance just to write it. I didn't really know how to write a TV series. I didn't really know how to write a book. I read this article about National Novel Writing Month, which the idea is you take a month, you sit down, you write a book. And I knew I'd never be able to, you know, sadly, take a month out of my life and ignore work and the kids to do it. But I thought, I really liked the principles of it, which was just write. And, you know, no plot, no problem. The idea being you just start writing and see where it goes. And that's what I did. I literally just sat down one night and I started writing as Lex and went from there. And what I love is that the first page I ever wrote when I sat down and decided I was going to write this book is still the first page of Killing It. Somehow it has survived all the edits and re-edits and moving around to still be there. So that was it. I mean, I wrote for a while until I even had a plot. I liked Lex as a character, and I thought it was a fun idea. And I just, you know, I'd come up more with anecdote more than plots in that. I'd just think, oh, well, imagine if this happened when you were doing this as a mom. And I don't know, it kind of went from there, really. I'd written quite a lot by this point, and I thought, well, maybe I should try and take it somewhere or make a go of it now that I seem to be really committing to this and many evenings have been lost doing it. And so I applied for a course on the Faber Academy, thinking if I get a place, that's it, I'm going to really commit to trying to write this book. And if I don't get a place in this course, then I'm just going to forget it, because, you know, I've wasted enough time on it. I've got enough going on. It's just a fun hobby, but I can't really take it seriously. And so, yeah, I was overjoyed when I got a place on the course. And it was 7 months. It was online. I got to meet you, Stephanie, and many other lovely people. Tom Bromley was our tutor. I found him absolutely brilliant. So for 7 months, we did this course where we were meant to be doing just the first 15,000 words. But because in my head, I decided this was my one shot. I spent a lot. I wrote more than I think I've ever written. I just kept going and going. And by the end of the 7 months, I had a full first draft, which was great. And then I did a mentoring session with Tom at the end, where he read through the whole thing and gave me some really useful feedback. So, yeah, that was how it started, just with an idea. And then it kind of snowballed.
Right. And then how did you get it out? to where it is now?
Well, it was actually perfect timing. I finished that first draft and then I was starting to think about, right, I've got to get ready to send it out to agents. And I spotted on Twitter that Joanna Cannon, another Faber Academy alumna, had posted about this Richard and Judy search for a bestseller competition. And I kind of read through the criteria and realised I met all of it and thought, well, why not? Didn't think I had a hope. Submitted it and then tried to forget about it, failed miserably and spent a lot of time wondering, wow, what if? And then couldn't believe it when I got a phone call one day saying, right, we're just calling to let you know you're on the final shortlist. So they got us down to eight.
Wow.
The final eight. And they said, you now have, I think that was the end of June. And they said, you now have to deliver a finished manuscript to us in December. And so that was it. I mean, for me, it was amazing because it was like the ultimate validation of what I'd been doing for the last 7 months hadn't been a total waste of time. Yeah. to get to the shortlist meant, wow, okay, someone out there, you know, people who know stuff and who know about writing think there's some potential there. So I was really excited, thinking this is an amazing opportunity and I've really got to make the most of it. And I was, yeah, thinking, right, I'm going to do nothing but write for the next, you know, 6 months to get this manuscript in perfect condition. And it's, you know, I'm going to put everything into it. But then I got pregnant and I get hyperemesis gravidum, or however you pronounce it, the extreme sickness that
the Duchess of Cambridge.
Exactly. She's made it famous. and so I was bedbound until October, having to be in hospital once a week on a drip. So all that kind of stuff doesn't mean you really feel in the mood to open up your laptop and start editing. So come October, I panicked a lot and was like, okay, it's fine. I've still got 2 months. And I just blitzed it. And in a way, it was actually quite helpful, I think, because I'd been so close to it for so long, having so much time away from it, or I hadn't even looked at it. I could read through with completely fresh eyes and think, okay, right, this is what I need to do. That was it, really. So I just got on with it and handed it in on deadline and then waited to hear from that. And I got the email, which was basically the best email I could have got for having not won, which was, sorry you haven't won, but we'd really like to bring you in for a meeting because we love the book. Pretty exciting.
Yeah. So then you went in to see them and they offered you a 2-book deal.
Yes, that's right. Before I did that, though, I managed to get signed to Alice Lutyens at Curtis Brown, which was amazing because it meant I got to go in there with an agent by my side, because obviously being totally clueless, I had no idea what I was
in for. A very sensible move, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Especially as I was heavily, heavily pregnant at this point and my brain was mush. So the book deal was confirmed the day before I gave birth. So yeah, it was a very, very happy month.
So you've got a brand new baby, one book is already written, but you've got a 2-book deal.
Yeah.
So you've got...
So one book was already written, but they hadn't had a chance to edit it. So I had my brand new baby and then I had my edit notes. So that was hell. And it was the start of the summer holidays. So I had the other three at home. And we just booked to go, and just in the crux of it, we were going to the Lake District for a 2-week holiday. And my poor husband, he had all three of the kids all day. He just had to take them out, entertain them all, and just leave me alone with the baby locked in our bedroom, chained to my laptop. So it wasn't the best holiday, but you know, when you're thinking of the bigger picture, you think, okay, this is going to be worth it.
Yeah.
And you know, we got through it just.
And you've finished book two now as well.
I've just finished book two, a rough first draft. It's got my agent, I'm sure, will tell me quite a lot of work to do to it. Yeah, I'm at the editing point of that.
Excellent. So what a wonderful, wonderful story that if you really put your mind to something, you can make it happen. And all those aspiring writers out there, just
it's a dream come true, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I think I'd say to anyone wanting to write, don't be put off by the fact you don't have a great plot or, you know, a great idea. Just you know, it sometimes just needs one little thing. Like I had an idea for a character, and that was my starting point, and I just started writing, and eventually everything else kind of came. So, because it can be intimidating if you're sitting down thinking, right, I want to write a book, like, where do you even begin? But if you just think, oh, I've got a nice idea, a nice thought of something that might work, and just write without really worrying about a beginning, a middle, and an end, you know, you're writing, you've started. And sometimes that's all it takes, really.
Mm. And I guess if you can't afford to go on a course, or you don't have the opportunity, you can find books on plotting and things that will help you along the way.
Yeah, actually, Richard Skinner from the Faber Academy, he's just his book on writing, I think, is just about to be released. And so I'm sure that will be a serious handbook for anyone.
Another way of learning to write, of course, is reading, because I think when we read, we tend to absorb certain things, and we know what we enjoy, and I'm sure that must impact on us. So who are the people that you read or have read? You probably don't get time to read now with four kids.
It really stresses me out when that phrase, everyone says, what is it, if you want to write, you have to read. and I love reading. It is just something that I do struggle to find the time to do, especially as normally by the time I get to bed, I'm so knackered. By the time I read about three pages, I'm asleep. But no, I love reading. I read all sorts. I mean, I have to say, the books I tend to go to, if I'm about to go on holiday for a week and I've got limited time to read, I would tend to always lean towards thrillers or crime, just because they're the types of books I enjoy the most, and I know that I'll race through. I love reading. It's just like you said, it's just finding the time. Every time you finish one book, you kind of want to just get straight onto another.
It's true. Do you have a favorite book that to read with your children?
Because they're all slightly different ages, I tend to read different books with each of them.
Yeah.
Well, who am I kidding? I read one book for three of them, because they all vaguely listen to it. And my eldest, she's on Harry Potter and Nina Blyton and things like that. So sometimes we read together, but mostly she's like, "Mummy, it's just quicker if I read on my own."
Bless her. And she can read at her level rather than at the little.
Exactly. And she's quite happy, which I'm like, hey, one less child to parent right now. That's fine. And off you go.
She's going to grow up fast.
Yeah, I know.
She's going to read your book, do you think?
It's awful. She keeps trying, and I keep having to say, look, there are a lot of swear words in it. I'm not proud of it. It doesn't make it big and clever. And so I've promised her I'll write a children's book one day so she can read that. I don't know how I'm going to have to hide copies from it, because every time I see her, she's kind of like leaning. If I'm on my laptop, she's leaning over my shoulder and starts reading bits out. I'm like, okay, that's really inappropriate. She is only six, so.
Oh dear. Well, six and an independent reader and reading Harry Potter, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, it's just one of those things that comes easy to her, luckily. So
Great. Brilliant. So what's next for you then?
Some relaxing, hopefully. Collapsing in a heap. I'm just basically trying to get through the next few weeks, which is publications and then getting book two into Bonnier. That's enough to be getting on with for the moment, I think.
Do book signings?
Yeah, I guess. All that ahead. Oh, exciting. I think the big moment will be when I finally hold it. You know, that moment when you actually see this book you've worked on for however long.
That must be stunning. Yeah, and then you'll see it in all the shop windows and things, and it'll be unbelievable.
I'm completely living the dream, and I every time I'm feeling completely run down or stretched too thin, I just think, this is what I've always wanted, so shut up, stop complaining, get on with it.
How lovely. Walk through an airport and see your book. Everyone picking it up to take on holiday with them. Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, that would be great. Well, I like to think it's a good holiday read.
So I'm really looking forward to reading it. I've pre-ordered
me
it.
Me too. Awesome.
So you're going to take the summer off.
Yes.
And then,
it's edits for book two. So you kind of forget how long the process is from when you're offered the publication deal to then the edits that go back and forth, and then it goes to copy edit, and then it's suddenly, you know, a year's gone by and you're just about ready.
So do you think that you'll continue in this series, or have you got an idea for something different?
I could write and write as Lex. I enjoy writing her. And I think what for me is interesting is in book one, it's all about returning from maternity leave and juggling. Whereas book two, which is the sequel, it's more about her daughter's now in nursery. And then it's kind of more juggling with school gate stuff and the pressures of that. So there is scope, I'd like to say. You never know, one day I could be writing about Lex blaming the menopause for the fact she looks flushed when actually it's because she's got a bulletproof jacket on underneath. there's scope for it.
And I understand the film rights have been sold.
Yes, they have, which is really exciting. But I love the idea of her storming onto the screen, this kind of badass mum.
Best of luck for the 12th of July.
Brilliant.
And enjoy your book signings and enjoy your fame and your appearance book at bedtime and Radio 4's book programme.
But you've got very high aspirations for Stephanie. But
no, I have no doubt that you'll be a big hot number this summer, and we got you first. Everybody to know that.
For the Right Club.
Big coup for us. Yeah, so well done. We're
thanks so much, Stephanie.
What an amazing woman.
I know.
Makes you feel completely inadequate.
Four kids and, well, three kids. Generate a fourth child alongside two books in 2 years. It's just remarkable.
I remember so clearly what it was like having two small children and just getting through the day. And then she was, you know, she was saying she didn't have time to read because she was so tired, but she did have time to write.
Well, it's what she said. When you start your day at 5 a.m, it's amazing what you can do. Maybe we should all get up 2 hours early.
Well, a lot of people in the business world are just doing this whole 5 a.m. start thing because they figure you're more creative in the morning.
Trollope used to write for a few hours before going to work at the post office. Anthony Trollope, not John, but he used to write for a few hours in the morning before going to work. And yeah, some people are just very organised. An amazing idea. And amazing
Brilliant.
That she's got a film deal.
It is going to be brilliant. I love the way she thought. She just focused on the next step at each stage. That was, you know, she was so self-deprecating, but she just focused on getting the next step done. Mm. It was a good
A novel is such a big thing that you can just put yourself off, can't you, by thinking, oh, my God, you know, 90,000 words. But it's all, you know, if you write 500 today and 500 tomorrow. Mm-hmm.
And just write.
And she said she did write in scenes, didn't she? She didn't worry about, you know, the writing it in chronological order or getting each element of each chapter right. She wrote in scenes.
Mm-hmm.
That was great.
I'm so looking forward to reading it. I've had a sneak preview because we were on a course together and I got to, you know, critique those. Yeah.
It's a great interview, Steph. You didn't sound like too much of a fangirl at all. And we all know you are.
No, I'm really delighted for it. It's lovely. Yeah.
And what a coup for us getting that interview.
Yeah.
Because I reckon in a couple of weeks she's going to be
solid,
on all the book programmes and, you know, Radio 4 and all the rest of it. So, brilliant.
Well done.
Well, it's nearly time to wrap up for this week, but before we do, there's just time for Heather and Jill Simpson to tell us what they're reading at the moment. So, Heather, what's on your bedside table?
It's a book called Blame by Simon Mayo, the radio presenter.
Oh, yes.
What happens when society wants you banged up in prison for a crime your parents committed? That's the situation in which Ant finds herself together with her little brother Matty and their foster parents. She's locked up in a new kind of family prison. None of the inmates are themselves criminals, but wider society wants them to do time for the unpunished heritage crimes of their parents. Tensions are bubbling inside the London prison network that Ant and Matty call home. And when things finally erupt, they realise they've got a chance to break out. Everyone wants to see them punished for the sins of their mum and dad. It's time for Ant to show the world that they're not to blame.
Wow.
What a great concept.
Yeah, a lovely idea.
It's a great read, aimed at young adults, but very good for older adults too. I've listened to Simon Mayo on the radio for years, and I have to admit that I expected a nice, gentle story, a bit like the man himself. But I found a dystopian, nail-biting thriller. Not what I expected, but a very, very good read.
Oh, good for him.
Sounds really interesting.
Just come out of nowhere with a novel like that. That's wonderful. Fantastic.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Brilliant. Okay, let's hear what Jill Simpson's reading.
Today we're talking to Jill Simpson, former senior lecturer in linguistics at the University of Central Lancashire. Yes. So, Jill, tell me, what's on your bedside table?
Well, I've just started early, Took My Dog by Kate Atkinson. What made me read it the first time round? Probably a recommendation, I think, from a friend. And then having started in the, not that one particularly, but starting with the beginning of the Jackson Brodie series, I just had to read them all. As each one came out, I read the next one. Well, I like all the characters. I mean, they're so almost unbelievable, but somehow you do believe in them. And they do the weirdest things. And the threads in the plot seem so disparate. And yet, in the end, they all come together. Well, for me, it's a very good read.
Well, sadly, that's the end of Write Club, the podcast for this week. Thanks for listening. And thanks to everyone who contributed to the discussion, especially our friends on the beach. Next week, we're exploring the rise of self-publishing with Laura Wilkinson and Kevin Long. Don't forget to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher or Radio Public, so every new show is automatically delivered wherever you want it. And please take a few minutes to leave us a review. Goodbye.
Bye. Bye.